Welcome back to the Monday edition of the CBSSports.com College Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Norlander, and I'm bringing Doug Gottlieb back on the show specifically to talk about the big news that loomed over college basketball over the weekend. It was actually a pretty dark weekend in sports overall. College basketball was touched specifically with the death of Rick Majerus on Saturday, and it was news that wasn't shocking, still surprising, if that makes any sort of sense. He had been, you know, laid up in a hospital for many months now. His heart was failing him. And unfortunately, he was in a situation where he was so old and in such bad shape that he needed a heart transplant, but he just wasn't a candidate for it. So unfortunately, he went on Saturday. And too soon, certainly very, very sad. You know, before we get to Doug here, just a real quick thing. A couple weeks ago when St. Louis had put out the note that Majerus was done at St. Louis and he would not be able to return after the initial hopes of a one-year hiatus, you know, I saw my colleague Jeff Goodman at Madison Square Garden, and Goodman, who's got, you know, plenty of connections and knows so much, he was like, listen, I think he's actually dying. Like, I just don't know how much time he has left. And I knew Majerus was in bad health, but I didn't think it was that bad. So when Goodman threw that on me privately a few weeks ago, I expected it to come, but even then, not this fast. So thoughts and prayers to everyone that knew Rick. I never got a chance to meet the man, but Doug did. He wrote a fantastic piece on our blog on Ion College Basketball that I encourage you to check out. It's linked in a number of blog posts as well. And there was so much good writing that happened in the wake of Rick's death. It's the bittersweet aspect to it. So we'll just get, you know, we'll start with this, Doug. I mean, if you want to expand off the piece you wrote or just get into that or any other aspects, feel free to share your thoughts and memories of certainly a college basketball coaching icon.
Yeah, well, I think there's several different kind of levels to it. And what I wrote about, and I was trying to condense, and I'm not very good at it, was the two main aspects to which our paths crossed. But there was also maybe two or three other different times in which I was more of an observer of Majerus. You know, what he did at Utah is the stuff of legend. And I mean, I remember the first time I saw Keith Van Horn. He dunked on J.R. Henderson, was my AAU teammate for 5 or 6 years. And J.R. was just, for his size and his skill level, there wasn't anybody like him. And then, you know, here's this really skinny guy with thick legs and like developed legs but no upper body, and Keith Van Horn dunked on him one day in our Slam and Jam League, and then he ends up popping up at Utah. And you know, where I started in the piece was talking about how I met him being recruited by him. And so I left Notre Dame, and I'm sitting out at a junior college, and, you know, his Donnie Daniels was their big Southern California recruiter, and Donnie called my dad, and he said, you know, do you guys have some tapes? We're going to call Notre Dame, ask them for some tapes. And you know, we're tinkering with the idea of maybe recruiting Doug to be a replacement for Andre Miller, because Andre's got just 1 year left and they could play together for a year. And I wasn't really that hip to the idea of playing with Andre Miller just because he was really good and I'd never played off the ball ever in my life. And I'm, you know, barely 6 feet tall, if that. So, you know, it was just one of the schools. And so he shows up at my practice in junior college. And what I was doing was I was sitting out, not playing, redshirting at a junior college instead of doing it on campus. And maybe this is a discussion for another podcast, but a lot of these freshmen that leave, it's stupid that they leave midway through their first year. I mean, that's just dumb. But if you leave at the end of your first year, you can go to a junior college, sit out, and wait to see how the kind of landscape changes in college basketball. Who needs somebody in your position to play right away? A lot of times, you know, somebody leaves early to the pros, somebody flunks out, somebody transfers out. Anyway, So Rick shows up with Jeff Judkins, his longtime assistant, and Donnie Daniels. So they pop up at my junior college practice. And so, you know, we go for like an hour and a half. It was a couple days before that team was going to play, and I was on the scout team. So they're like, hey, man, do you want to work out afterwards? And, like, you look at these guys, and you're like, man, I can't do that. That's a violation. You're like, no. That's where the differentiation between breaking a rule and cheating is. This is breaking a rule. So they literally like close the doors in this gym and just grind me, work me out. He has me take all these different shots from all these different angles and all these different passes and off the dribble. And like, you know, like, and he's like coaching me like it's like a one man practice. And, you know, we take water every now and again and he talks and kind of, you know, analyzes. And it was just like, you're almost like out of body experience. Like this, here's a guy who's like a guru coming in and just analyzing every different part of your game.
Was it intimidating or exciting at that moment for you?
Both.
Okay.
Both. And so he's like, yep. You know, you could play, you know. Listen, here's the thing. You know, I'm not even going to go further and recruit you. Just, you know, you got to tell your dad. He can call me and we can talk about anything in the world, but we can't talk about basketball. And, you know, my dad's 19 years a coach in Division I, but he just had a rule. Like, I'm the basketball coach. You're sending me to play for – you're sending your son to play for me. I don't want to talk to you about it. And so I was like, hey, that's – I'm good with that. So he's like, all right, I'm hungry. Let's go to Spoons. So we go – and he was trying to be good. Like, he was telling me about how, you know, he's on this diet and whatever. Meanwhile, like, he, like, starts, like, reaching over and grabbing a fry while we're talking. And I was like, dude, go ahead. Knock yourself out. I don't care. And then he liked my burger, so he, like, grabbed the waitress. Let me have one of those. And we just sat there and, you know, BS'd. And he went from, like, telling me exactly – it was just weird. Like, you know, some coaches are very honest but not detailed. You know, it's a lot like maybe presidential hopefuls, you know. Mm-hmm. Some guys give you no details at all. Just say, hey, vote for me. You want to vote for me because you like me, you know. Mm-hmm. And then some coaches give you more details. I mean, he was like to the, you know, I could see you playing like 26, 27 minutes early. And then, you know, like conference games probably, you know, I like to trim my bench and I go from 8 to 7. And when I go to 7, then you could be like 32. And, I can't play Andre more than, you know, 28, 29 because he gets tired and, you know, I can't run stuff for him. So those minutes you would be at the point. And like he was like, dude, I hadn't even taken a visit. This is like months off. I haven't seen you play. I haven't really kind of thought in my mind, is this really going to work? I don't know. I've heard, you know, horror stories about how hard it is to play for you, about how you curse guys out, you intimidate guys, you know, like, can we just, but he was very, very specific, overly analytical. And I was, you know, fascinated by it. And then we, you know, kind of broke off into talking about Milwaukee. I was born there. My dad was a coach down the street from Marquette at UWM. And, there was that connection. He talked about his mom. He's very passionate about family and, you know, he talked about how, you know, he loved to come back to Southern California and, you know, the only job I'd ever leave Utah for, you know, is UC Santa Barbara, you know, because you could walk on the beach like right before practice. And if I walk on the beach, I don't think about food, you know. So it was crazy. And then I went to their practice. And, dude, when I tell you, like, his practice was a work of art. And now, keep in mind, when I think back and I played for, you know, a guy I deem, and I think most people in coaching deem, one of the all-time greats in Eddie Sutton. He ran a really good practice, very competitive practice, but I wouldn't say in any way it was a work of art, you know, because he was older and he taught, you know, there were days in which he really wanted to coach and he would talk a lot and there were a lot of standing around watching him coach. There were days in which it was a war and he didn't say anything. He just sat there and took notes on the sidelines. It was different. When I was in Russia, I played for a guy named Sergei Belov, who was the best player on that 72 team. His practices were interesting and unique. I played for John McLeod at Notre Dame, who coached 18 years in the NBA. You know, I played for probably 10 other coaches professionally, and they were all different. But I'm telling you, it wasn't even close in terms of the best practices. Maybe the only one I would compare it to, honestly, is Brad Stevens.
Really?
Yeah, in Stevens is so detailed and so seamless in how they'd go from drill to drill to drill and everything with a purpose. But this was the day before a game, and you know, he knew he wanted to be off the court in an hour and 35 minutes or something, and they were off the court an hour and 35 minutes and they covered everything. And you know, he had these five guys that were like stiff, big, tall, probably Mormon walk-on dudes that, I mean, they were basically like the lackeys, and they go to breakdown drills and they would be the defensive dummies. And then they go run, you know, 5-on-0 offense and they would be ball feeders. And so like when they'd run a play, every guy got a shot. And then those guys are like scrambling after to get the basketballs. And then they have to go out and run the scout team offense while the starters sit and take notes. And like it was fine precision. It was fascinating. But to me, the thing that stuck out the most was, like, look, he used incredibly foul language at times. Sometimes it was mean. Sometimes it was just the way he was talking. And I do understand the difference between both. But, you know, he'd say, like, Keith, that's bullshit. Give me two. And, you know, like Keith Van Horn would sprint over to the corner and get on the end line, and he'd run down and back those two lines. And, like, he wasn't looking, but you knew those guys either feared the hell out of him or respected the hell out of him, or kind of a little bit like the question you asked me, a little bit of both. And so it was a crazy experience. And, you know, truth is, I maybe would have gone there if not for the fact that they changed this Prop 48 rule, to which Andre Miller got an extra year of eligibility. But just that little experience alone was fast. And then when he came up to ESPN, you know, it's one of those where on paper it's the perfect forum for him. You know, because if you want to, ESPN affords you so many different platforms to which if you just want to be – because his whole thing is, you know, I don't want to do any of this bullshit. I want to talk ball. I want to talk ball. And you're like, all right. So, I mean, you know, tell me what you want to do, because if you want to do like a podcast – well, this is before podcasts.
Right, right.
But you can write pieces on it. You can do video stuff. They had digital back then. You know, they got – it's not like they have 18 networks. They have somewhere where you can just talk – but the problem was that he had it in his mind he never wanted to be in Bristol. And I had this conversation with him, and I didn't share this in the piece. But I was just like, Rick, why do you hate Bristol? It's like you live in a hotel, so you're coming up here to be in a hotel. What's the difference? You know? It's like, well, you know, it's just, you know, I like doing the games, I like the energy of the games. And that's – it's a very different thing when you're watching the games and you're around people who – there's some TV people, there's some young guys who just love basketball, but you're not around the game. And there's a guy who loved the game, and the game loved him back because he had a way of teaching it and coaching it that was incredibly successful. Now, one thing I put in my piece was, and, you know, I'm sure there can be like, hey, man, wait till the body cools a little bit. He wasn't all peaches and candy and roses. Okay, this wasn't some fairy tale. It wasn't just like he used bad language. He was brutal to guys. He did take a dump at mid-floor when he was at Utah. Like, that's not urban legend. That's true. Seth Davis's piece, and this is not a bad thing, this is just a weird thing. He would, like, he didn't care when, like, a reporter would come up and was doing a story on him. It's like Seth Davis wrote a really good piece on SI about how, like, he just sit there talk to you, and all of a sudden he's butt naked. And you're like, dude, hello? I'm in the room.
Yeah.
This is what's going on here. But it was like nothing to him. He was just so singularly and solely focused on basketball. Now, look, he had to, and this is, I don't know, do you like to do this, Matt, where you like give dime store analysis of people's psychological state? Do you ever do that?
Like what? Give me a for instance. I mean, maybe, I guess, but.
Well, I mean, like, so you try it, like, okay, so why would a guy who, I mean, like some players, like you talk to him about Keith Van Horn or Andre Miller, or some of the great players at Marquette, or even the guys recently at St. Louis, and you're like that's like a dad talking about his son, and then you hear how he, you know, would treat others and your other players, and you're like, dude, well, how could you almost be bipolar? And so I like to do like dime store analysis. I'm like, I'm thinking to myself, here's a man who he obviously hated himself. I mean, that's – you don't have this type of self-destructive behavior, because that's what it is when you – right? I mean,
yes,
isn't that –
yeah.
Okay. So if you have self-destructive behavior, yet you're incredibly successful and people look up to you, there's something going on there to which instead of – one, you take it out in your body by eating and the drug that is food, and two, you take it out on others, secretaries, people who worked at the hotel – you know, players that he didn't, for whatever reason, kind of jibe with. You know, I brought up the you know, the kid Mark Jackson, the point guard at Utah, who quit. And when Jim Boylan got the job the next year, he's like, "Hey, man, coach, I want to come back and play." He's like, Jim's like, great. He's like, there's this one thing. It's like, there's this word you can never call me. He's like, well, why would I call you a name? He's like, well, you can't. Please don't call me the C word. No, I'm not going to say it because I don't know this podcast.
No, yeah, don't say it.
Okay. And he's like, and Boylan is pretty hardcore. You know, he's in the NBA for a long time. He's with his own. He's like, why would I call you that? He's like, because that was my first name to Rick. He's like, that's why I quit. Mm-hmm. I'm like, what, you know? And I don't know. So I don't know what Mark Jackson ever did to earn that status. But it was amazing because from seeing him and how he coached with passion to seeing him and when I was at ESPN, like he befriended me. He was one of those guys where if you – you didn't have to suck up to him. It's like if he respected you, thought you worked hard, and thought you really wanted to make him better and make it work, then – for whatever reason, he was really good to me, and he was really good to a couple of my producer friends. But there are other people who I've just sat there and like, you know, you don't treat people that way. You don't talk to people. You know, producers would not know what he's talking about, and they would they would ask him like, I don't understand, and he would just, you know, F it. You know, you don't know, you're a TV guy. You don't know anything about basketball. But like, you know, you sit there and watch him watch an NCAA tournament. And the way it worked then was we had this, you know, like war room, and it was me, him, and Lavin, and you know, we're taking notes and we're talking and telling stories, and you know, somewhere in the room, Digger's taking notes to which no one can understand or comprehend. He's telling old stories, and
I've been in that situation. Yes, I know. I know exactly where you were. I sat in on the 2010 tournament with Digger and Dick Vitale in that war room first day, and it was interesting to say the least.
Vitale awake the whole time?
He was awake, and him and Digger off record really like they are brutally funny but vulgar, and yeah, they go after each other like no holds barred. He was awake.
Yeah, because Vitale has a tendency at times to wear down, and he'll just like pass out, okay, like half, and he'll wake up and go, Howie, what happened? What happened?
Yeah,
and Howie's like, Dick, here's what happened. He tells him like the blow up a whole story. I got to go back and watch it. Like, no, we don't have time, Dick. And you know, and then he'll mess with Digger. He'll mess up his car anyway. So you know, Digger's they're doing their routine somewhere in the other part of the room, and Majerus is just like, you know, I mean, you shouldn't guard him. You should be pressuring up on him. And if, you know, should run some, you know, flex action here and post it. You're like just sitting there going like, yeah, great, awesome. And it's like having cheat codes in a video game. You're like, dude, this guy's awesome. And then he was, and this is one of the things that I really liked about working with him on TV. You know, he didn't like being told you can only talk for 45 seconds. And he would have a tendency to just go on and on and on and on, run a sentence. But because of it, you know, if you said something really smart and like set him up, and I'm somebody who has a tendency to, I run over my time limit as well. He would make me seem like I was talking a shorter period of time. And he just, again, he'd like to talk ball. He's like, I just want to talk ball. Mm-hmm. You know, you guys do the video thing. I just come to me. I'll talk ball. And he was great. He never complained about the extra work in March because he did actually like talking about the games and giving some thoughts. And then the other thing about ESPN is because they only have the rights to put on, you know, 4 minutes of actual tournament highlights, when you're doing TV shows during the NCAA tournament, there's no constraints. You get to talk more. So he actually liked that, was in a good mood, and was really cool. And, you know, he would talk openly about his health. He would talk openly about, you know, things that he'd do different when he coached and about the past. And I don't know. I grew to really like him, but I know there were two sides to him, and as there are to so many of these guys. And I think with him, it wasn't as much that he was a bad guy and he liked the power. Because I think some of these guys that are two-faced, it's that they're bad guys and they like the power. And they were nice guys once, then they turned and they became superstars, and then they have a Naismith complex. Like, I don't think he even had the Naismith complex. I think it was more there's some sort of self-loathing there, mm-hmm. and he acted out on himself and he acted out on others. That's my dime store analysis.
And I think we just set a record. You just smashed Parrish's record. One question, 15 minutes, but it's exactly what I wanted. A couple quick notes here. One, you had mentioned the Seth's piece, and one of our commenters early on the Obit piece I wrote for Majerus on Saturday night. It was just a simple comment that I thought it just made me laugh when I read it. It read simply, RIP, great, great coach who was cool with casual nudity. And I was like, you know, if we could all just be like Rick Majerus in that way, wouldn't the world be an amazing place? You did a drive.
Can I tell one? I'll tell one.
Yeah, go ahead.
This is my favorite story.
We're talking, you know, male nudity, of course I'm going to give you the floor. So by all means, go ahead.
Okay, this is a male nudity story, okay? So do you remember a guy named David Jackson that played for him?
Oh, no, I do not. I'm sorry to say.
David Jackson, I think he was Oregon Player of the Year, very heavily recruited in. Like 2 years, like he hated David Jackson, so he just didn't like him as a player. And so here's what happens: so David Jackson is transferring out, so he goes to Gonzaga to visit. So Fuey, those guys are great, and they like Rick as well. And so they sit down to dinner, and I don't know if you've ever been on a recruiting trip with any a player or with a coach when a kid comes to town, but generally, you know, there's always like one nice dinner where all the assistants are there and the recruits there and whoever comes with the recruiter, somebody comes with them. And then like a player, two players, whatever, you know, if it's Jim Herrick, then it's like the whole team. And then you put it on one person's bill anyway. So David Jackson sits down, Fuey and all his guys are there. And he's like, and so the kid's like starving hungry. He's like, no, can't start. Give me your best Rick story. He's like, oh. He's like, no, we can't do anything until we hear your best Rick story. Because there's all kinds of just crazy stories out there. So David Jackson's like, all right, just the other day. And they're like, the other day? He's like, the other day. So he says, like, just the other day, I go up to Rick's hotel room because I want to ask for my release. And he was really cool about it at the start of the year. And like, coach, I don't think this is going to work out. And he's like, give it till semester. And then at the end of semester, I want to talk to him about it. And he said, we're not back in school until, you know, whatever, first week in January. Like, you know, let's see how it all plays out. Anyway, so I go up to see him. And, you know, when you ask for your release from a coach, even if it's gone really bad, if you're not playing, whatever. I mean, these guys are all intimidating father type figures. Then you manifest itself in Rick Majerus. You're going to go up to his hotel room and, you know, ask, hey, coach, I don't want to play for you anymore. Can you give me my release? So David knocks on the door. Come in, David. So he's in a towel.
Naturally. Just goes without saying, dude. I mean, obviously.
And I want to make sure and point this out. There's nothing wrong with being gay. Rick Majerus is not gay. His girlfriend, I believe the same girlfriend as when he was working at ESPN, she was quite attractive and incredibly, incredibly nice. And so not that there would be anything wrong if it was gay. So when people hear like male nudity, especially with some of the recent stories, like, no, this is just like the guy did not care. So David sits down in a chair and he's like waiting for Rick. So Rick comes, he's like, well, how can I help you? How can I help you? He's like, you know, Rick, and I'm saying Rick, not out of disrespect, but that's what he wanted people to call him. He didn't have guys call him coach. So he's like, you know, I was thinking about what you said, and David was telling, like, I had my head down because I couldn't look him in the eye, one, because he was naked, but two, because, you know, he's Rick Majerus. So he's like, you know, I was thinking about transferring, and I wanted to get my release, whatever. So he looks up, and Majerus is sitting in a chair across from him snoring. Out. Just – so he's waiting. He's waiting. So finally, he's like, so he like shakes him. He's like, Rick. Oh, sorry, David. I'm so sorry. Listen, I'm taking this medication and it just makes me sleepy just at real inopportune times. And he goes, so he looks David like dead in the eye when he's telling him. He's like, and then it's got one of my balls really swollen. And he goes, hey, coach, I just want my release. Can I get my release? I got to go.
The whole, like, you know, thumb over his shoulder. Coach, I got to get out of here, but yeah, are we cool here?
My balls is, like, swollen up the size of a softball. Like, whoa, TMI, coach. So Anyway, that was his story that he told to Mark Few and the guys when he visited Gonzaga shortly after leaving Utah. There was also a night at ESPN. He got in his contract that he, until Bob Knight, I think he's the only one who had it, where he didn't have to wear a tie. Mm-hmm. And so I don't remember what happened where he, I don't know if he had a jacket or what it was, but he came to town, didn't have a jacket, and so he had to go like the men's warehouse, and I think it was like a size 56, like short or something ridiculous. And anyway, there were these lights, and he basically had one jacket, and he would just like leave it in Bristol. And it's actually still the last jacket he had is actually still at my buddy's desk at ESPN. It's at Rob Lemley has it like in his office at ESPN just because like coach's jacket, you know.
Yeah.
But it like caught on fire one night because he left it like you guys smell smoke. Like there's Rick's jacket caught on fire. We gotta get him another jacket. But a size 56 coat was quite interesting. And then, you know, obviously the national championship game, but lost in that was beating down Arizona that returned, you know, Mike Bibby, Dickerson, Miles Simon from the national championship team with a triangle and two, to which I don't think anybody was prepared for in that team. So he was a legend. And, you know, I some people might say, if they listen to this podcast, like, boy, you know, there's a lot of negative to like your piece. I'm like, okay. I mean, I can't help the fact that this is how he was and who he was. Despite it, he was somebody that people really, really respected in the profession. But just so you know, when you're trying to paint an honest picture, it wasn't easy. And I think there was some emotional baggage there that he carried over. And unfortunately, it takes away from so many of the great things that he did. And some of the right things that he did in terms of promoting education, really loving many of his players. And, oh, yeah, by the way, if it's about winning games, he won a lot of games.
Absolutely. And, you know, for everyone listening to this podcast, if you saw the news, maybe only gave one or two pieces a quick read. There's plenty on the blog from Doug. I mean, Gary and Goodman wrote really nice reaction pieces.
Yeah.
They were. I compiled kind of a best of Rick Majerus, but in that I wanted to be sure to make notice and to give backlinks to a couple of instances of certainly the man's character flaws. And I think that overall he's been treated pretty fairly and accurately. You know, he just died. Obviously, there's a tendency, the right tendency to float to the good stuff, but he was certainly complicated, and your piece really was unafraid to go in a number of different ways, and kudos to that for something that was really well done. You've got a certain perspective and an approach to these things where writers, since we were never really directly in the game like you were, it's just a different lens, and so it really lended itself to a nice little piece on Rick there. So,
all right. Sure. So in honor of Rick, let's talk some ball, shall we?
Let's talk some ball. That was my miserable Majerus impression, by the way. Okay, so there's a whole bunch here. You know, it's funny. I text Doug. I'm like, you want to come on and talk Majerus? He's like, I got all this stuff for you. So you got like a slew of topics here. To me, we've talked about UCLA before. We can definitely go back there. And let's just do it really quick here, because to me, they remain interesting because the problems keep changing. They can't seem to get out of this vicious cycle of whatever it is. I mentioned this on the podcast with Seth from Friday, with Seth Davis, that I think actually for Josh Smith, it's actually good that he just gets out. To me, I think it's got to be something depression related. He wasn't helping himself there. And if you want to comment on that quickly, feel free to. But here we go, UCLA, all this talent not doing anything. We talked about this when you came on, you know, a month ago, not even. And nothing's really changed yet here.
Well, let's start with the first sentence that everybody starts with, and they say, all this talent. My answer is what talent?
Really?
Oh, well, tell me who the guys are that, you know, a part of it is, and I've been working on compiling a piece for Goodman trying to find the right time to talk about this. But look, I mean, Kyle Anderson's he's big and tall, and I guess he can pass. And so maybe that was overwhelming to guys when he was in AAU ball, but he's a non-athlete and he's a non-scorer. And so, look, that doesn't mean he's not going to be an NBA player in 2 or 3 or 4 years. But, like, he basically plays between the three-point lines because he can't get in the lane. He's a perimeter player. And so, like, all right, so who are their quote-unquote pros? I mean, Muhammad Shabazz doesn't look like he's in great shape. He's finally now playing his right position, which, truthfully, he's a college four. And the one thing that Josh Smith leaving allows them to do is it allows them to slide him to the four. And that's what they've done. And he's, you know, now he's still not a great face-up shooter. He's not a ball handler. But if you can get him 15 to 17 feet from the basket and scoring Gorin towards the basket, and he got a chance. But then it goes to the bigger problem. So, you know, look, Jordan Adams, I think, has been better than people thought. On the other hand, I think there's a little bit of fool's gold to it in that he just – every time he gets it, he tries to score. And that's going to become wearing on guys like Muhammad. I saw the game last night against San Diego State, and Shabazz's body language was not good.
At all.
Not good at all. He did not look like, dude, I'm fired up. This is just – we're having a bad game. He looked like, what did I get myself into? These guys don't know how to give me the ball. This is not working. Whereas Jordan Adams is like, he's trying to shoot the ball as if, you know, every shot's a heat check. Larry Drew stinks. He's just not good, you know. And this is not a personal attack on him. This is just at his game. You know, he sat out a year and a half, and in the process of the last month, he didn't really have confidence in his first game. Didn't look at the basket. Then he took a couple shots, and the next couple games he hit a couple shots. And, you know, last night he looked like a guy who you didn't have to guard at all. And, look, I was a guy who you didn't have to guard at all because I couldn't shoot. But at least I knew how to create and make plays despite that. He looks like he's still trying to prove to people he can make shots. There's one point in the game, late in the game, they're down six, and he takes a three and shoots an air ball. You just can't do that. So the first thing, and this there's a parallel to this throughout many of the teams that are struggling, Kentucky, UNLV, some others, poor point guard play is going to derail you and going to make all of your players look a little bit less talented than they actually are. Secondly, I think the question is, did people misevaluate the type of talent that they have? Is the talent just very young? Or does the talent not fit together? And I would say it's a little bit of all of them. And I do think that Anderson has a chance and Jordan Adams has a chance and Shabazz has a chance. But they got to learn how to play basketball at this level. And so far, Jordan Adams' game is the only one that's transferring and translating. And then, you know, you got the Ware twins. They're fine. They're solid. They're productive. They really are just role players. When they're your two kind of go-to guys along with Shabazz, you're in trouble. And then, you know, you got Tony Parker, who's just – a younger, less talented version of Josh Smith. Like, at least Josh Smith can play. Tony Parker can't play, and he's fat. So, yeah, they got some issues going there. And then, you know, Ben, he decides to go zone, and it works for a game. And it was decent against San Diego State, but he's not a zone coach. And so late, they went man and looked better. But can they play man when they look so disinterested and unable to play man early in the year? Because Anderson can't guard. Larry Drew doesn't look like he wants to guard. Shabazz struggles to guard. I mean, they have nobody to protect the rim. And then they have no bench. So they got some issues there. They got some major issues working there.
Are we looking at a situation with Kentucky where Calipari is going to have a season-long problem at point guard, unlike anything he's had since prior to, 2007?
Yes.
Okay, and so if that's the case – what is the reasonable expectation for Kentucky big picture? I know once you get in the tournament, anything can happen, and that's a separate issue. But altogether, should Kentucky fans, you know, dial down their expectations, hope to finish, you know, third in the SEC? Is second still the likely scenario? And are we looking at 22 to 23 wins, or is it still going to float closer to 30, and you think this team might have the natural talent to overcome the point guard issue, which I'm guessing you don't think so as a point guard yourself?
Well, there's a couple of things here. One, I'm not as down on Nerlens Noel as some people are. Like, oh, he's like, hold on.
To me, he looks better with every game, but what do I know?
I think he's terrific. I really do. And, you know, consider what he's doing without a point guard. He is getting better every game. he's an incredible athlete with good. He's a good shot. Like, don't compare him to Anthony Davis. They're two totally different players. Just take him by himself. He's averaging essentially a double double. And, you know, I think he's blocked. I was checked the other day with like 20 shots already. He's tremendous. I still think they'll win 25 games. I think we're underestimating. You know, look, Baylor's got two veteran guards. They played very well. For the most part, they've been very smart. No one beats Notre Dame at Notre Dame. And Duke in November, with all those starters back, that's a hard game to win. But, you know, what are the games that they're going to lose? I mean, you're sold on Louisville. Vanderbilt's bad. A&M's not very good. Tennessee's looked just okay this year. Who are the teams in the SEC? Alabama on the road, tough game. Florida on the road, tough game. Tennessee on the road, tough game. Outside of that, maybe Florida at home. There's not a ton of teams that are going to beat them because they still have a ton of talent.
Mizzou?
Let's get to the Mizzou thing in a moment.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think Missouri changes dramatically without Dixon. Yeah. Dramatically. Like, I had them winning the league. They're not winning the league without Mikey Dixon. No way.
I had them winning the title.
You had them winning the title?
Yeah. Just for fun. They asked for our picks, and I just went with Mizzou. But with no Dixon, that's out the window. But, okay, so listen, Kentucky's...
So look, they still, I mean, dude, they still have... I mean, I don't know what Poitras is, whatever his, like, position. And, you know, he doesn't have any real skill yet, but his skill is he's just a freak.
Yeah.
You know, he's like a 6'5 and a half, 6'6 freak athlete. And the other guys are going to get better. You know, the big difference for this team is not just point guard. It's that, remember, last year they had point guard issues first half of the year. And it's not just they don't have Anthony Davis. Last year they had Miller. Last year they had T. Jones. Last year they had Deron Lamb. They had three pros, three vets, three guys back from a Final Four that, and I can't believe I'm saying that Terrence Jones had a calming effect, but there were times when he had a calming effect because, you know, also, you know, he was the guy that Calipari could scream at and take all the pressure off everybody else. This team has no point guard. And like so many of these teams that are struggling, and UCLA is this way, Vegas was this way when I've seen them, no leadership. Like, you can have a point guard and not have great leadership, or you can have great leadership and not have a point guard and maybe get away with not having one or the other. When you don't have both, that's a bad sign. So I think, can they win the national title? I would say unequivocally no. But can they get to the Sweet 16? Sure. I mean, college basketball's not that great. They're still very, very talented. Rupp's still going to be a hard place to play. And very few teams can match them athletically like Baylor can and then throw out a veteran backcourt.
Yeah, meanwhile, Baylor is looking around saying, like, can't we get any credit? But I'm sorry, you know, Kentucky loses. Kentucky's the story. Props to Baylor for giving Calipari his first home loss, which was something he clearly coveted. And there is a certain, irony, if that's what you want to call it. It's not the right word, though, in that, you know, Indiana and Kentucky couldn't agree. Cal and Crean couldn't agree to the series to cancel it. You know, Kentucky picks up Baylor, and Baylor's the one that ends home streak. I thought that was interesting.
It was apropos.
Apropos, there you go.
There's one thing about the Indiana, and they looked great last week. But we have a tendency to lose our mind when a team looks – no one was beating Indiana the other night. Nobody. The Pacers might not have beaten Indiana the other night. Okay, but Indiana was great at home last year. They'll be great at home this year. And if you ask, like, some of the old Hoosier players, they'll tell you there's a different assembly hall now than previously. It's like they've been mediocre and bad for so long that there's almost a little bit of edge to Hoosier fans, whereas before it was a bunch of old white-haired men who are all wearing Bobby Knight sweaters and then some students. Like, now it's a young crowd, and they are into it. So it is a very difficult environment. But – like, look, I watched the Georgetown game. They're not going to run the table and go undefeated. They're not so clear-cut the favorite to win it. I believe it's a wide-open year, and we have a tendency, based on the last thing we've seen, to make these overwhelming statements. The difference between between Indiana and North Carolina, and even though North Carolina was embarrassing defensively in that game early on, remember, Duke last year got blown out by Ohio State. You come back from Maui, that's a long trip. Your body's trying to adjust. Plus, North Carolina's not that good. Plus, it didn't have, by my estimation, their most complete score, their third leading score. And Indiana's great at home, and they played really, really well. And they hit a bunch of shots, and, you know, they got it going. So it wasn't that's a false 30-point win or whatever. It's just the difference is not that great. Indiana's not going to be that dominant.
What about Duke? I mean, everyone wants to have this Indiana-Duke debate. I'm not really that interested in it, to be honest. But Duke looks awesome. They've got the best resume. You know, they would be the number one overall seed probably if you, you know, started the tournament tomorrow, you know, for whatever that's worth. But
would you pick them to win it?
I might. Yeah, I might actually. Because I think I just can't believe how good Plumlee's gotten, dude. I mean – Seth brought up on Friday on the podcast. Have you seen a big man in 1 year, his final year, transform and get this much better in so many different facets, like the way Plumlee has so far? I can't remember one. Guy is the player of the year pick right now.
Yeah, dude. Seven games in.
I know. Hey, I'm just saying. But hey, seven games in against the best competition in the country so far. So, are you down, relatively speaking, on Duke? Like, obviously, they're good.
No, I'm realistic about Duke. Like, I mean, again, I think that this is their ceiling is different than some of these younger team ceilings. They got to figure it out. You know, Seth keeps getting hurt, which is he can't get hurt. Here's the difference in Duke. Okay, if you go back and you watch the game against Kentucky, late in the game, all they wanted was Seth and Mason Plumlee on the same side, ball screen game, or just him, you know, having Seth feed the low post because he can't help off of Seth. And they felt like Mason could score or get fouled or sweep and use his, you know, use his athleticism and, you know, dunk on somebody in the baseline. But in order to get there, they had to turn their offense over. And, you know, I'm pretty close with a couple guys in that staff, and they told me unequivocally, look, they could not have done that last year. And people don't want to hear this, but Austin, it was a split team last year. It was Austin Rivers and it was everybody else. It's not that Austin Rivers wasn't successful. I mean, he hit the Carolina shot and he was the one guy who could really break down the defense. It was just they couldn't run offense. And this is a group of guys that has to score off of some of the stuff that they run. They can't just go freelance like Duke 10 years ago, high ball screen, spread it out, and then we're just going to climb into you. They need to run things. They need to screen. They need to have good spacing. And even then, sometimes it doesn't work. So that's the first thing, is that this is a team, whereas last year's was not. The one that won the national championship was a team, not a collective talented group. I mean, they were really good. There's some similarities there. The big difference is not Mason Plumlee. It's Cook.
Right, who I've thought would be good. He's been better than I expected, and Goodman's got to eat crow on that because he was a Cook. He was down on Cook to start the year.
I was down on Cook. You know, I was down on Cook because I didn't like him, and they didn't like him. Mm-hmm. They were like, can't remember what we want to do. He's constantly going off and doing his own thing. He doesn't make shots. You know, typical when you think, boy, we're just not good enough at the point. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Tyler Thornton does everything they want him to do, but he can't score, and he's really should be a 10th man. And so, like, what are we going to do with these two? And then we have, you know, a freshman, and we have Seth, who's always hurt, and Seth not particularly good defensively, and he's more of a shooter than anything else. Well, Cook has played his tail off, played really, really well, and that's changed this team because otherwise – nothing else works. You can't run ball screen game with Ryan Kelly. But look, they're still susceptible to the fact that Kelly won't be able to cover, you know, like last year they went to play Ohio State in that game we were talking about. You know, there were just guys that Kelly couldn't guard. Now they also had guys who they couldn't guard with their wings, to which now Suleiman, how do you say his last name?
Suleiman, I believe it
Suleiman.
Is.
Yeah, Suleiman changes them as well because, you know, even though he's a freshman, he's got the kind of moxie and he's got the nuts to guard some dudes that they didn't have in previous years at those two wings. Andre just didn't have it last year. So it's an interesting team. And the big thing is it is, in fact, a team. You still got Harrison to come in and take a couple charges. You got Tyler Thornton to come in and to, you know, play ridiculously hard, dive on loose balls, as long as he doesn't shoot the ball, I like the team a lot. And that's the type of team that could win a national championship, even though, you know, they probably have, I guess, Suleiman and Mason Plumlee will play pros, probably the only two pros in the whole team. But it's a really good team made up of veterans who know their roles, have accepted their roles, and are flourishing within their roles. And they're also running offense, which Duke, frankly, hasn't done enough. The last time they ran offense, they won a national title. In the other years, they've been a little bit too much freelance because they've had talented guys who are ball stoppers, as they call them. Ball get to their hands and everybody stops and watches. That's what they had last year.
I will wrap up the pod with this. You said you've got sneaky good teams and horror awful. Okay, horror awful teams. So give me a little of column A and a little of column B here as we have gotten into December, the second month of the season.
Vanderbilt is horror awful. Like the drop off.
Horror off the cliff, yeah.
Yeah, like from three pros and a team that underachieved, you know, on paper, had a great chance to play in the Final Four last year, just lacked the toughness to ever do so. But still, you know, second round team, whatever, to they're awful. I mean, really, really – Wake Forest, really, really bad. Like how they don't make a change there, I will never understand. And it's funny, like I thought Villanova was one of the worst – you know, one of the worst kind of teams that used to be like 5 years ago was awesome. What the hell happened to Villanova? I mean, this is like that's a you want to do a 30 you want to do a 30 for 30 at ESPN? Dude, what the hell happened to Villanova?
I don't know if that would get huge ratings, but I know. And within college basketball, it's interesting. I saw them play in person at the Garden, and Jay Wright assured me it's not the same team. And then they go out and they lose, you know, two more. They look just miserable, dude. I mean, is he – I don't want to get off on a tangent, but, I mean, does he love that job? Or, you know, there were whispers back a few years back that he would want something bigger.
He had a chance that he could have had any job he wanted. I mean, there's some people who thought that he could have had Kentucky, you know, and then it kind of started to fall apart right before Kentucky came open. And then Kentucky had Calipari and it's over. And so there were thoughts that he was the one that he wanted Texas. He could have had the Sixers job before. And now it's like, now you're stuck. Now you stayed too long and you're like, you're stuck and you got to get it going again. Yeah. So, yeah, they're not good. Texas, TCU, ugh, not good. Really, really not good. Oh, my goodness, not good.
All right, what about the sneaky goods?
There's some sneaky good teams out there that people are kind of – I don't want to say – I hate the sleeping on them because interrupts your street cred. They're sneaky good. Everybody has been up on Colorado. I haven't been as up on Colorado as some would be. And Arizona's not going to sneak up on you. I've seen Oregon. I like them. I like their team a great deal. Now, they have freshmen in the backcourt, which gives me the heebie-jeebies. But I think they're a borderline NCAA tournament, but they're sneaky good. Ole Miss is a team that's 6-0 right now that everybody I talk to in the SEC is like, hey, man, you know, you should keep an eye on. You should keep an eye on this Ole Miss team. They're kind of, frankly, sneaky good with Marshall Henderson, who's he shoots a lot, but I like Murphy Holloway a great deal. He's a double-double guy, and you know Summers isn't bad. He's you know not a scorer, but he can run a team a little bit, and they're going to get after you and guard you. I'm not sure what to make of them as far as NCAA tournament possibilities. Another horror awful team, by the way, is South Carolina. Frank Martin, oof,
yeah,
really, really, really not good. Not good. St. Mary's is kind of struggling this year. They don't have a lot of shooters around. We could go on and on about other guys. Let me just give you one more thing. A team with incredible talent like Kentucky that I think they're getting better, but I can't figure out if they're ever going to be good because they don't have a point guard is UNLV. And it's one to keep an eye on. You know, they have Anthony Bennett, who's a Canadian kid, who's a 6'7", dominant animal when he's down at the low post. He likes to float out and shoot jump shots. But he's down low post. He's very, very good. They get Ken Birch eligible here in the next couple of weeks. They claim, and you know, everybody claims this, best guy in practice. Not really a scorer, but a very good athlete. And then that'll slide Mike Mosier out to be a three. I don't like him at a three. I think he's a four. They don't have a point guard. They're playing Anthony Marshall at the point. He's a great defender. He's a great athlete, but he's not a point guard. And then they have two of the most remarkable chuckers. I've ever seen. Like, you want to see two guys who literally shoot the ball as – there's a rule when you're playing pro basketball, especially in the minor league level. But if you're playing pro basketball, and this happens in Europe as well, it's kind of a known thing that, like, when you dribble the court, if whoever's man is coming to check in and take their spot, like, you usually let that guy pinch off a shot or two before the buzzer sounds.
Yeah.
Well, if you've ever seen Bryce Jones play, who transferred from USC, or Caton Reinhardt, who's a freshman from Modern Day, you would swear that they live life with the theory that there's always somebody coming to check in for them. Because these two kids shoot the ball so quickly, I've never seen anything like it.
A couple of Costanza chuckers out there is what you're saying?
Like, Costanza would be like, they're chuckers.
Yeah.
Like really, Caton Reinhardt thinks he's Jimmer Fredette. Here's the problem. Jimmer Fredette, it took him a couple years before he got that green light, and even then he could pass. Now, this kid will shoot and can shoot, but holy hell. If they can figure it out and get it together, they have some veterans, Justin Hawkins, Anthony Marshall, Mike Mosher. They have some talent in Reinhardt, Jones, Bennett, Birch. They're still a dangerous team, but I don't know, no point guard. And again, no point guard, no leadership. It could easily be a team that has some crash and burn in them if they don't figure it out.
And that league is fantastic this year. Hey, you did a great job. Loving having you on the podcast. If you are not following Doug, do so on Twitter at Gottlieb Show. He's got all sorts of stuff. I mean, he already does a lead off every night at midnight Eastern on CBS Sports Network. And the studio time for CBS Sports in the Big Boy Channel is coming, as is some color commentary and play-by-play. And then in about a month, he'll have the daily Doug Gottlieb Show on CBS Sports Radio, on the CBS Sports Radio Network, that is. So
yeah, we're gonna do 53-minute segments there too.
And this was a marathon. This is the Grateful Dead of my podcast, basically the Grateful Dead version. We go on a little long here, but it's a nice rolling, slow boiling jam of sorts. So I appreciate
favorite. Give me favorite team you've seen that other people haven't talked about.
Oh, geez, man, you're putting me on the spot. The favorite team that I've seen that, in general, people haven't been talking about a lot?
I don't know, but from your perspective.
Okay, I think this one's an easy one. It's a really good team. They're still undefeated, but I really like Syracuse. I think Syracuse is going to get to a point where, legitimate Final Four team could be a better team than it was last year, but that primarily comes from Carter Williams, because I'm slowly but surely developing a massive man crush on that kid. And then
I love him.
Yeah,
I had them winning the Big East. I didn't have them going to the Final Four because I bought in the Louisville thing. But I'm with you on some level. Can I give you one real quick?
Go ahead.
I like Ohio State more than other people do.
Okay, I mean, I feel like a lot of people like them though. Like, if you like them more than other people, you would say what? Like decent to heavy Final Four favorite? Because I mean, I think a lot.
I know they're ranked number four, which I thought was massively overrated. But, like, you know, then they lose to Duke and people just completely like, oh.
And they were – I mean, listen, credit to Duke. But, dude, I mean, if you watch that, if you pull a – like my dad, if you watch the first half and go to bed, I mean, you think that Ohio State's, cruising with that and they're usually going to win. But, turned around on there. What do you got going on there, man?
Sorry, something just popped up in my computer. I was like,
sorry, Parrish did that on last week's podcast. We made we gave him some crap for it, so it's all good.
Yeah, I can't figure out. I like the way Illinois plays. I can't figure out how long that lasts. They shoot so many threes. Oh my gosh!
I know
they shoot.
Credit to Gross for taking over. And getting off to getting the Maui. I know they got a few breaks there, but still.
No. Oh, I'll tell you the team. I still think, like, we're doing all this how good Duke has looked thing.
Yeah.
How good is Gonzaga? Dude, they're really, really good.
I picked them for the Final Four, man. So, I mean, I just, we'll see what they got to actually prove that, by the way. Their March reputation has gone in the tank in the past 7 or 8 years, so we'll see what they actually do. But, they look awesome. And
you will really know by the end of December, because they get this Wazoo game, which – I don't think there's any way they lose that one, but it's a rivalry game. Then they get Illinois, Kansas State in, I think that's the battle in Seattle. And then they go to Oklahoma State on New Year's Eve.
Baylor, they do. They got Baylor in there as well. So
Baylor, yeah, they do have Baylor. So this is, I mean, like, they play a sick schedule.
Yeah, it's awesome. Sick. No, it is very good. There's a There's plenty of teams out there. Listen, we'll get you back on. Don't worry. We're going to cover all 347 this year at some point. So,
no, we don't have to do that. There's some teams not worthy of being covered. I've seen them.
I know. I see, man. All right. Hey, listen, I appreciate everything, and we'll get you back on soon.
Great stuff, Matt. Thanks so much for having me on.